Welcome to Dragon Years, Remembrance of Times Past. This is the third episode of this special podcast series, and we will be discussing with Bill Simon the year 2000, and then at some point we'll go back and look at 1988. For now, we're going to look at the year 2000. Bill was a pioneering China trader, an entrepreneur, a man with exceptional experience and knowledge of China. So welcome, Bill Simon.
Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here.
2000 was a very special year. It was special in a couple of ways. It was the first full year of Duihua operations. Duihua was established in 1999, April. I asked a group of business people whether or not they would be willing to join the board. My first question, Bill, is when I asked you whether or not you were willing to join the board of this fledgling organization, what went through your mind?
I was honored to be asked to join the board of this organization because I had followed your career for almost the previous 10 years in which you had made some amazing strides in promoting human rights in China and U.S.-China relations. And personally, I had some guilt in having made a lot of money in the U.S.-China trade business and thought that in some way I could return some of that good fortune by helping to improve U.S.-China relations and helping improve the status of human rights and dialogue between the two countries.
Now, this is a kind of a silly question, but do you have any regrets joining Duihua?
I don't have regrets. And I think that although there have been ups and downs and the road has been paved and unpaved, there have been super highways and blockades along the way, that in general, Duihua has made a tremendous impact in forwarding the understanding between the two countries, not only improving human relations. So no, in general, I have no regrets.
Do you think business people make good human rights activists?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that good question. I hope that we've helped in a way that pure human rights and social activists might not, because our relationships dive deeper into society where we're working with businesses, corporations, factories, manufacturers, traders, and in that way we sometimes have contact with the parties on both sides that maybe a politician or a pure activist might not. So I hope that the answer to that is yes.
Moving along to our December 2000, that is, trip to Beijing, we were there to give a presentation organized by the People's Institute for Foreign Affairs. We did this, and it was well received. One thing, though, really stands out. The questions that came from our Chinese friends in the audience, there must have been, 100 people in the audience. It was a big audience. And by the way, all kinds of people, I mean, all different ministries, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, et cetera, the public security people. What struck me is, you know, it's been 10 years since the whole big fight over MFN began. It was still going on at that point. And they don't seem to have absorbed about how the U.S. political system works. How are bills arrived at? Hearings and things like what is a filibuster and so on and so forth. Do you agree with that observation?
Yes, I do, John. I was flabbergasted. Frankly, I was there for moral support, and you did most of the presenting, but during the Q&A, we both were able to pitch in and were astounded that so many very highly educated officials from the Chinese government, some of which had studied at U.S. universities, had such a little understanding of how the process worked. And I believe there was significant Q&A regarding the U.S. Supreme Court debating or discussing and ruling on the legitimacy of the vote in Florida and finally rejecting the recount so that George Bush ascended to the presidency. And they were completely mystified on how that came about. And we were fighting to try to explain to ourselves as well how that all worked.
In fact, looking back, I'm not sure we did a good job on that precisely because I'm not sure I understood how that all happened.
Well, then the Supreme Court make its ruling until December 12th. So we didn't. We were in the middle of some really tough questioning from people who should understand the process, considering that the U.S.-China Trade Relations Act was passed around the same time. Business was good. The relations between the U.S. and China were on the still rising. And for us not to be able to answer that properly, or for them to not understand anything about it, was mystifying to us.
Bill, you just mentioned the U.S.-China Trade Relations Act, which was being considered at the time we made our presentation in Beijing in December of 2000. What is the significance of that act? What did it seek to achieve?
It was really one of the most consequential documents probably in the history of U.S.-China relations, in that it normalized trade relations so that instead of having U.S. Congress approve a most favored nation trade status for China each year, the act made it permanent, and it's now called PNTR, Permanent Normalized Trade Relations, which really opened the door for not only expanded trade with the United States, but China's entry into the World Trade Organization. And so essentially, the act established China's compliance with international human rights laws and forced China to comply with international laws regarding religious freedom and protection of labor standards, and essentially changed the way China had to behave in conforming with international law.
You know, Bill, we both testified in favor of most favored nation, MFN, in 1990, and I think in 91 as well. And I have to say, it was brilliant to change the name from most favored nation to PNTR, Permanent Normal Trade Relations. So that was a big deal. Okay. They did join the WTO. They committed to improving human rights. They committed to improving trade practices. Do you think they've honored that commitment?
In many respects, no, because we know that China is not complying with all the labor laws. They're still involved in the violation of intellectual property laws. We're not quite sure how they're protecting religious freedom. And I think the U.S. Congressional Committee that was established by the act has not lived up to the expectations of those that created the act.
Yeah, speaking about that, as part of the deal to get China into WTO, the so-called Congressional Executive Committee on China was established. It's quite an interesting and unique organization. It's bipartisan and it's bicameral, so it involves both the Senate and the House and both parties. Now, a little bit of background for the audience. Originally, I came up with the idea of establishing a bilateral human rights commission between China and the United States. But my dear friend Nancy Pelosi put the kibosh on that one by saying, we can't appear to be on an equal footing with China on human rights. So we had to just go with the CECC. And I've always felt that was a mistake, because now all we do is preach at the Chinese. They have no way to come back. And well, here we are today. Recently, President Xi Jinping visited Europe, and during his trip, he said China will never forget the Belgrade bombing. China was humiliated. Well, all I can say is when we were in China to give that presentation, no one remembered it. Did you sense any animosity?
No, I thought everybody was very friendly. No one brought up the bombing. And in various discussions post that bombing event in China, in different provinces with different manufacturing operations and trade partners, no one ever brought up the subject of the bombing in Belgrade.
So after the bombing, I was already executive director of Duihua, I made a donation to the families of the people who were killed. We were one of the few who did that. So in addition to helping out on Most Favored Nation, supporting China's Olympic Games, and so on, there's that. So I think it's one of the reasons that we've had such a good relationship with China over the years. What do you think, Bill?
Oh, I think that's true. I think that Duihua has been very even-handed, has been non-prejudicial, and has gone bent over backwards to be direct and cordial with both sides. And I think the Chinese government and Chinese officials appreciate Duihua's behavior and its technique.
Now I want to go back just a little bit. Now, 1988 concluded a few months before that terrible tragedy in Tiananmen Square. I was in China while that was happening, but I wasn't in Beijing. But I seem to recall that you were in Beijing.
Yes, I was in Beijing from June 1st to June 3rd, and I was hosting the chairman of Eddie Bauer, who was a customer buying down sleeping bags and down jackets from my company. We were walking through Tiananmen Square, and it was loaded with protesters. The freedom statue, or the goddess of liberty, however you want to call it, was in the center of the square. And it was peaceful protesting. There was some police presence, of course, but it was kind of a festive environment that reminded me of my days during the free speech movement and the Vietnam War at the University of California in Berkeley, frankly, and the activist peaceful protesting. Little did we know that the next day all hell would break loose, basically. But very exciting memory and a sad one at that.
It did change China. I actually spoke about that at the Commonwealth Club, how Tiananmen changed China. I guess it changed you as well. I mean, my perception, my view of China changed a lot after that.
And mine did as well. We were on an upward trajectory. We're improving U.S.-China relations. There, in the beginning, when we first started in the 70s, there was a misunderstanding, not an understanding, how each country worked. And there were thoughts that maybe that the relationships would not progress. But in fact, they did. The doors opened slowly. We got to know each other. Engagement between Americans and other foreigners with China helped open that door, and it was progressing fairly well, I thought, on both sides. And Tiananmen Square was a reminder that this was an autocratic, militaristic country that we hadn't really seen as businessmen on a day-to-day basis.
My last set of questions, Bill, is this. Since 2000, when we gave that presentation, when Dui Hua, first year of operations, the U.S. presidential election, how has China changed?
If I focus on my own experience, I would say that it gradually changed for the worse. And at the year 2000 was not the peak, but not near the peak of wonderful economic prosperity. Trade relations had improved. The U.S., through its acts and trade agreements with China, paved the way for China entering the World Trade Organization. It seemed like all was well. But as time progressed, there was a sense of distrust starting to creep into the relations. And 2012, I believe, was the year that Xi Jinping ascended to the secretary of the party and began slowly to change his own view and move China away from the United States, beginning to create that distancing, which is now peaking, where there is a great deal of distrust on both sides, and relations probably couldn't be worse than they have been in the last since the year 2000, which is kind of a frightening reality and something that we all need to try to do something about.
Here's another question along the same lines. We've talked about how China has changed. How has China stayed the same? Of course, it's an ancient civilization, but how has it stayed the same?
Stayed the same because I think the people, not the politicians, not the leaders, are still trying to live a great life, taking good care of their families, being close with their friends, and trying to make a better life for themselves. And in that way, I think there's a lot of commonalities with the way we think as Americans and as most people on this planet. But I think the governments have created this aura of distrust, or China moving toward what it considers an equal level of power in the world and wanting to be more, in some way, independent from other great powers. And at that higher level, there has been that change. But at the grassroots level, I think it's stayed more or less the same.
You know, China, the words for China, Zhonghua, mean the Middle Kingdom, tells you a lot about what they think about their place in the world. But you know, the word for the United States is the beautiful country. And that's, I think, how they still feel. I know that some attitudes have changed, but I still think there's an underlying goodwill You agree?
I agree. And if you go to China even today, you'll see people wearing Nike shoes and drinking Coca-Cola and wearing polo shirts from Ralph Lauren and feeling good about the American people at the grassroots level.
One thing we agree, though, that right now the relationship is pretty bad. And frankly, I think it's going to get worse as we go into the election year. We're already seeing signs that the two principal candidates seem to be trying to outdo themselves. But what do you think we need to do to improve the relationship? How can we improve U.S.-China relations?
We need to improve the public relations campaign so that Americans see that China and the U.S. have so much in common. The two greatest powers in the world should be getting along. On this small planet, we cannot be adversaries. That can only harm the rest of the world, not only ourselves. Public opinion polls show that 70%+ of Americans have unfavorable opinions of China, more or less.
To your point, Bill, I've actually gone and looked at some of the recent polls about U.S. attitudes towards China, and they're really abysmal. I don't know what else can be said. I'll give you a couple of examples. In the Gallup poll taken in February of 2024, 20% of Americans had a favorable opinion of China, 77% had an unfavorable opinion, and 2% had no opinion. Now compare that to November 2000. You had a 36% favorable opinion, not great, but you know, better than 20, and a 57% unfavorable. Well, that number has gone up 20 points. That is quite a stunning deterioration. I'll just give you another poll, the so-called YouGov poll that was taken very recently, in May, actually. And in that poll, 82% of those polled Americans considered China to be an enemy or unfriendly. 82%. Ally or friendly, 8%. That's single digit. That is a terrible number. Now, Bill, given these numbers, would you say that these kind of opinions, negative opinions, are impacting U.S.-China relations across the board?
Of course. I mean, this is really a dangerous situation that our political leaders have put us in, because a lot of these opinions are shaped by the president, the administration, the opposite party, and its leaders by castigating China, potentially making it our enemy number one, and fomenting what might be the beginning or intensification of a new Cold War. And I think we, as a country and as individuals, need to show both sides. There needs to be a common ground, and that has to take precedence over military and cyber warfare that's going on at a higher level.
Well, Bill, I find myself agreeing with you on so many things. Duihua has tried hard to improve the relationship, and we've tried to, you know, tell positive stories when positive stories are due. I'm not talking about whitewashing or sugarcoating. No, you know, we've been critical, but I think we're seen as fair. Fair and balanced, not to coin a phrase. But that's what we've tried to do, as have you. But thank you very much, Bill, for your contribution to this and for your contribution to U.S.-China relations and to Duihua. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Okay, well, that brings to a close episode 3 of this special podcast, Dragon Years, Remembrance of Times Past. Farewell and good night.
That was John Kam, Duihua Executive Director, speaking with Duihua Director Bill Simon on a range of topics, including the state of U.S.-China relations. You can listen and subscribe to our Dragon Years podcasts at www.duihua.org. Be sure to check out our stories and publications, including our latest prisoner updates and digest. Thanks for listening.